history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Each year, Memorial Day gives us an opportunity to pause, to reflect, and to honor and remember the more than 1 million Americans in our more than 240 years of history who have given what President Lincoln called their last full measure of devotion for the sake of freedom, liberty, and the ideals of our country. I know you're used to hearing World War II veterans on this show, but this time we're going to hear a younger voice. He was wounded in Iraq, losing a leg, but eventually gaining a mission to help other veterans in need and to attack an epidemic that is adding more rapidly to the number of those we remember on Memorial Day than anything else. That source of casualties that occur long after our veterans have left the battlefield. It's been said that 22 veterans per day commit suicide. And you'll hear Justin Bond say that because of the way statistics are reported, the real number might actually be higher. It's tragic, and it has to stop. And we're going to hear how Justin and his fellow veterans involved with an organization called Our Heroes Dreams are working hard to stem that tide. But we're also going to hear the incredible twists and turns his own story has taken to bring him to this point, starting with conversations he had as a child with his grandfather, Warren Wooten, who had served in the Merchant Marines in World War II.
Yeah, my granddaddy always would sit there and tell me the stories about what it was like in World War II and show me the scars, and he wouldn't talk to any other grandkids or anybody else, his wife or anybody. And one day he told me, he said, the only reason why I tell you all this stuff is because I know someday you're going to be the one to go in. He goes, someday you're going to carry the torch of freedom. And I can remember 4th of July nights, everybody would be outside, and I would sit in the room with my granddad, and sometimes he would cry. He would turn the TV up loud, and he said, sometimes the bangs bother me, but sometimes it's just the thought and the memory of what our guys went through. And when they celebrate the 4th of July, they don't understand what those bombs in the air mean. He didn't tell a lot, but enough to definitely gain a whole lot of respect for the brotherhood. And that's mostly what he talked about, was the brotherhood. And not patriotism, not for the country. You do it because of the guys that have your back and you have their back. And so I always knew I was going to go in. I always just knew. And when I got old enough, it was natural. And I was homeless at 14, as it was, and different things, living on the street. So as soon as I was 17, I went down and talked to a recruiter, and they helped me get a GED. They got me in. They said, well, you have to have a high school diploma to get in. But they said twice a year we allow GEDs in. And so they did that, and they tested me on the ASVAB and asked me what I want to do. And the very first thing I saw was combat engineering, their book, and I loved it. It was driving a D-8 dozer and playing with C-4. I said, put me in.
You know, you mentioned being homeless at 14. I'm not trying to poke and prod, but I'm sure that raises some eyebrows for people. They want to understand, well, what happened there and what was that like? I'm sure it's not easy to be homeless at 14, and you don't know what the future is going to hold.
Yeah, I think it defined me early on, and it wasn't hard for me, just because I guess that's my personality, is to accept whatever's there in front of me and go with it. But I actually lived a pretty good homeless life, I guess. I would go and stay at the hospitals. I would take showers in the empty hospital rooms. I would stay in the chapel. The chapel was always empty at nighttime, and I would go over and curl up on the back pew. You know, we'd always get hospital food, so we did that. And my uncle worked at the hospital, and I would visit him quite a bit there in ICU, and I'd sit there, and sometimes I'd do the food run for him, and they didn't even know that I was out there homeless. My uncle didn't at the time, but my mom had been paralyzed from a car wreck, and she didn't know who I was and was in the hospital for several years. And my dad was out doing, he was a contractor, and eventually went to drugs, and we were taken with CPS and different things. But it defined me for who I am now, though, so it made combat very easy.
You're talking about it like it's no big deal, but this is life-changing stuff. It sounds really lonely, scary, hard to know what is going to happen in the future. But you didn't have those concerns or fears, or there was something that got you past it?
My grandparents always showed me the spiritual side, and so I had that walk at a young age. And then my sister was 2 years younger than me, and so she ended up being homeless with me for a while, so I was taking care of her. So you don't even think about yourself at that point. You know?
You had a mission.
You had a mission. And I ended up putting my dad in jail a couple times, and then he ended up getting cleaned up and doing good, and ended up about the time I was going in the Army. He was cleaned up and doing good getting out of jail. And then my paycheck was going to support my sister. And my sister ended up getting her license at 18. And she was coming out to live with me in the Army. And she had a wreck and died on the way. And so another life changing. That one wasn't easy.
Man, I mean, people are just going to get pummeled over and over again when they hear the different parts of your story. And already, what a start we're off to. So you're just starting out in the Army as a teenager. Your mom had been paralyzed in the wreck. You told us what was going on with your dad. Your sister's just been killed. So what in the world were you thinking as you started your Army career?
You know, I ended up blaming God. I ended up blaming everybody. I ended up busting my wrist up a few times from punching brick walls in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and busted my ankle up a bunch of times and went AWOL, and pretty soon we were deploying to Bosnia. Actually, what happened was my grandma died. 2 weeks later, my grandpa died. 2 weeks later, my sister died. And they said, man, you're negative a month in the hole for leave, and we're deploying to Bosnia. They said, we can't send you over to Bosnia over a month in the hole. They said, you can come, or you can get out on a hardship and come back in when you get everything squared away. And I was a mess. When my sister died, that was it. I was a mess. And I said, all right, I'm going to take that option. They let me out, gave me an honorable. I went to work, and I started paving. Ended up getting crushed by a paving machine. Ended up getting crushed by a Ford F-550 and a semi hooking up to tow while I was towing the paving machine. Ended up getting metal pelvis, hip, and tailbone, and that's when 9/11 happened.
You're killing me, man. And everybody listening, everything you're talking about is like a huge, overwhelming deal for most people, and you're saying it like it's no big deal. You got crushed between a pickup truck and a semi.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it was 3.5 inches thick sideways. The safety chain came down and kept the trucks somewhere between 3.5 and 6 inches thick is what they said. And the truck, the Ford F-550, the wheels were just spinning, and it had me crushed up against the truck with the safety chain saving it out in the desert. And then somebody came in, got in the Ford F-550, stopped it, and moved it back. When you, with the truck off but in gear, you push a button on the tow bar and it inches forward and you hook it up to tow.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the last one out on the job, and that's what I was doing. I was going to tow it home. The key was in the on position, and it started and just crushed me. So I was pronounced dead on the scene. They actually had video on the news when the helicopter was there, and they said they kept asking me questions. I couldn't answer it, but in my mind I could. And they said, we're losing him, we're losing him. And one of the doctors that had come out that was driving by, he said, time of death, 5:16, and they covered me with a sheet. And 3 minutes later, they heard the end of my prayer from underneath the sheet. And this was on the news when I saw it on the hospital bed. I was just like, wow, you know, I just died.
So you're conscious when they put the sheet over you and you hear them say, time of death, 5:16?
Yes, sir. I heard it. Couldn't respond, but I knew it was happening. I was praying.
What do you pray?
I just said, Lord, I'm too young. I got a lot. You know, I believe in you. And I want to keep doing what's right out there. Next thing you know, I was awake.
And so they heard the end of that prayer. And they realized you were alive.
Yes, sir.
Should you have been alive?
Well, it's not my call when I leave the earth, I guess.
Basically, your whole body was compressed to 3 or 4 inches thick.
Yes, sir. Complete metal pelvis, hip, and tailbone after that.
No internal injuries, organs?
Yeah, it was all crushed. It was bleeding internally. They rushed me to surgery after I got to the hospital, and again, I died on the way to the operating room. They covered me with the sheet again, and the doctor said, he says, I don't believe in God or higher powers. He says, but I wasn't going to be able to save you on the table, but we were going to try. And he goes, you died on the way, and then you came back. And
wow.
He said, nobody can die that long and come back normal. And he said, so somebody out there did save you.
You're a walking miracle.
Yes, sir.
And we've only heard a part of it so far. So this is happening while you've already been discharged from the Army, and this is right before the attacks of 9/11, 2001.
Yes, sir. I watched the towers fall over and over and over, and all I could remember was going into like a church or an event, and everybody said, you know, hey, thank you, veterans. Veterans, stand up. And I would never stand. You know, I didn't even finish my first tour. And it cost the country $1 million of training and then left. And so I felt that I had to go back in. For one, all the stories from my granddad would run through my head, and the brotherhood that I did see there, and all the training that I had, but I was never able to put it to use. And so I had to. So I went down to the recruiter, and they're like, dude, you're in a wheelchair. I'm like, I'm going to get up and I'm going to train. And they just laughed at me. And I knew it was a long shot, but I kept researching online and kept trying to get up. And pretty soon I was on crutches, and they said I would never walk again. And pretty soon I found a clause that if you've been out less than 4 years of the military, you can go back in under your old medical. You just have to be able to pass your PT test whenever it comes up. Mm-hmm. So the recruiter put me in under that, knowing the situation, and I somehow avoided all the PT tests leading up to going to Iraq. I found a unit out of Fresno, the Fresno 1072nd National Guard that was deploying, got put in there, ended up finding my way over there without ever having to take a PT test.
Why was it so important to you? I mean, you've almost been killed. Well, you had died a couple times and come back. Why was it so important to you to go over there and serve our country?
It's weird in life how you go through stages. And at the time, watching those towers fall, it was like a bully came over and punched us in the gut. To see President Bush put out the war cry, and to see all the Vietnam vets and the Korea vets and even World War II vets wanting to go back in, you see that brotherhood. You see that your home is under attack. And as a, well, not an able body, but as a, in my mind, an able body man, ready, I can defend my country. I can do something. You can put me in a turret, and I can defend a convoy. And so I had to go. I didn't have any choice. In fact, the military was trying to hold me out because of my injuries before. My family's like, what are you doing? You can't go. And I'm telling them, no, the military's making me go because I'm prior service. I have to go. Next thing you know, their military's like, you're not going. You know, you can't run.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm forging doctor's letters and all kinds of stuff to be able to go.
That's determination, no doubt.
I came to a point to where I knew God was holding me out. I started having seizures. I ended up in ICU for 10 days. Couldn't figure out why. They said, it's like you're having a heart attack, but you're not. And it ended up being my thyroid. I found out later. But all these things. And the military is like, dude, you got problems. You know, you can't go. And then the family was fighting me. You know, you're not going. You're not going. And I had a fiance there that was trying to hold me back and a one-year-old son. And next thing you know, I cussed God out. I had a heart-to-heart with them. And I told them, I said, you're not stopping me. I'm going over. I'm doing this without you or with you. But I'm doing this and we'll deal with it on the back end.
Didn't know what you were getting into, did you?
Nope. Be careful what you ask for.
Have you ever had one of those conversations like that since?
On the opposite end.
Yeah. Kind of figured. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll get to that. So somehow you end up back in the Army and you're heading over to Iraq. What are you going to be doing over there?
I was going to be a SAW gunner on a gun truck escorting convoys in and out of Taji, which is just outside the green zone in Iraq. You know, I love the SAW, shoots 760 rounds a minute when it's turned all the way down, even though they're just little tiny rounds, but, you know, compared to a 50 or something like that, it was an awesome weapon to be on. And I didn't care what I was doing over there. You know, it wasn't the combat engineer stuff with C4 and building and blowing up bridges and things like that, like I originally went in for, but I found the closest unit that was deploying and signed up with them. And I absolutely loved being over there with the 1072nd out of Fresno.
Well, and you mentioned you're leaving behind a fiance as well as a one-year-old son. Any thought in your mind I might not see them again?
I tried not to think about that, but yeah, I did. Especially the last day when we're getting our final formation and we're heading to the airport from the guard unit. We're heading out to get on the plane and you see them all over there, you know, and it was like, oh man, what am I doing? And so I wouldn't even look. I just kept my eyes forward, walking formation. You see other people, kids going up to daddy and, you know, and I was just like, oh, shut it out. But yeah, it was a real thing at that point. We were in Kuwait and I hated Kuwait. The smell of the oil, the taste of the oil in the food was just horrific. And I thought, man, this sucks. I don't know if I can do combat. Kuwait was horrible, the sandstorms and this and that. And we were there like 10 days and we got to Baghdad and we got into Iraq, it all changed. It was desert, but it wasn't sand. And the food was good. And the water was good. And combat was much easier than Kuwait, I think. You know, we got out there and we had little old ladies, 60 years old or so, get out on their hands and knees and kiss our feet and say, God bless you. God bless your country. And God bless your God for you coming to die for me. We saw the difference even early on in 2004 of how women's rights were starting to change. And so today I look back and I tell everybody, you know, hey, I don't know if we were there for whatever reasons you guys want to say, the oil, the revenge, whatever it may be. Those women are now free. Those women are working in government, in schools. They can choose if they want to be married to that guy or not. And I saw a lot of women die over there, getting beat to death because they just looked at another guy. And maybe that is their culture, but we helped free that up a little bit so that they have the next step of their freedom. So to me, it was worth it.
So your job was to man this gun on some kind of armored personnel vehicle, or what do you typically going out in?
Either a Humvee as a gun truck or a PLS, palletized loading system, which is the heaviest truck that the Army owns. It's 86,000 pounds empty. You know, a semi going down the road can only be 80,000 maxed out. 10-wheel drive, 6-wheel steering. So every time you turn the steering wheel, 6 wheels move. Just an amazing piece of equipment. You can go in under fire in combat, download a Connex, and pick up a new one and take off in under a couple minutes.
Are you one of several guys doing what you're doing, or are you the only guy that has that job in that vehicle?
In that vehicle, yeah, I was always the gunner. We had, in our company out of Fresno, of 144, I think we had 6 SAW gunners. Sometimes I was escorting a general and a colonel. Sometimes we were escorting equipment, or sometimes the Hajis, the Iraqi workers, we'd escort them, whatever the case may be.
But that's a heavy responsibility you're carrying there. I mean, you've got some precious cargo that your job is to protect.
Yeah, and fortunately, training kicks in. You don't think, you know, if a bullet flies or a threat emerges, you don't think. And if you do think in combat, you're dead. You don't have time to think. If you think, is that a bad guy? Boom, you're gone. And so you have to know instantly, and you have to have a clear head. And some of the biggest, baddest people over there that I looked up to so much, you know, my leaders, when the bullets started flying, they started crying. They hit the deck crying. And yet we had females that popped up and proved to be the leaders when the bullets started flying. And so it's amazing in combat to see who's going to emerge. And you never know.
Yeah, not until those bullets start flying, as you said. I mean, what kind of threats are you looking for? It's probably a pretty tense situation, not knowing what's out there and what could be a threat, what's not. What were you looking for?
Yeah, different things, different areas. When you got around Fallujah or those areas, you know, the threats would change. It would be like you're in a parade going downtown Baghdad. You're waving. Kids are out there. People are throwing candy to the kids, throwing a set of shoes out to the kids, and life is good, and it's like a parade. And you get towards Fallujah, and then it goes from waving to people running for weapons. They almost deployed a whole battalion because the guys we were replacing said, hey, we're leaving in a couple days. We can go around Fallujah for 6 hours, 8 hours to get to the back base, or we can go through it, which is too dangerous, but they're not going to be expecting us. We went through it. The generals and everybody got all up in arms. That guy got in a lot of trouble, and they weren't ready for us, or we would not have made it.
Wow. So that was your first experience with Fallujah?
5 days into Iraq, I think, then. So it was pretty new. I was sitting up on the gun truck, and I could hear some four-letter words, and from the front, like, where are you taking us, you know? And the guy's like, don't worry about it, and he was going home the next day, so he was just trying to make sure he got there and back.
Well, I know that we're going to hear about another time in Fallujah that didn't work out that way, but anything else in the interim from when you first got there to when you were wounded that stands out in your mind that was significant or left a powerful memory with you?
We paid the Iraqis $1 a day and up to $5 a day, and they would work hard for us. They cut your hair, they clean the latrines, they do all kinds of stuff for you, whatever the job that they need. And we hired around 10,000 people a day at our base alone of 30,000. We had a lot of people there. So they work for you during the day, but then we always heard, okay, they could be attacking you at nighttime, and it could be the same ones. Our very first firefight, I was on a deuce and a half, and I had a female driver. We're coming back from Mosul, the most northern base by the Turkish border. And we're coming back, and we're like, whoa, what is that? And I don't have any armor at all. No protection, no armor. I'm in the back of a deuce and a half, bouncing around, just trying to keep my sitting upright. And they're here, Bond, who are you firing at? And I said, I didn't fire at anybody. Go up the road a little bit, and geez, it's so close. He can smell the gun smoke. Bond, who are you firing at? I said, I'm not firing at anybody. And I said, can you smell the gun smoke? She said, yeah. I said, well, we're going forward. It's in front of us then. It's beside us. And I'm trying to reason with her, and I'm watching. I don't see anybody. Mm. Who do you fire at? So next thing you know, they opened up on us, and it was tracers going way above us. The insurgents pay them $100 a day to attack a convoy. We pay them $1 a day to work hard for us. The insurgents pay $100 a day. It's hard to compete with that. And in the end, multiple firefights where they didn't want to hurt us. They never hit the vehicle.
But they're just firing, so they get paid, but they're purposely missing you.
Yes, sir. We had our 50 gunner, and a lot of times bullets would fly, and he would never fire around. Everybody's, why aren't you firing? They're not hitting us. They're totally missing us on purpose. And so he would recognize that. Well, he was like 6'6". He could have a better view than most of us, but...
Well, that sounds all great and wonderful. That, you know, it's comforting to know that people are not trying to hit you. But doesn't that mess with your bearings and your sense of what? And I mean, does it give you a false sense of security?
It does, because your natural reaction is they're firing, I have to fire back. You know, the people you can see the next day during the day when they're working for you, they won't look you in the eye. You know, and you're like, you're the one, you know, you've been out attacking our convoys. The $5 that we might pay them a day if they're higher educated, or the dollar a day, that will feed their families for a week, 2 weeks. Think about that $100.
Yeah.
Think about what that's going to do for their family.
Yeah, hard to resist, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's time for our first break, but when this special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes continues, we'll hear about a day that came so close to claiming Justin Bond's life, instead leaving that life forever changed, and leading to the mission he's on now to help returning vets and prevent suicide. Learn more about his organization, Our Heroes Dreams, at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a departure from our usual conversations with World War II vets to meet a man for whom Memorial Day weekend is very difficult. He's a Purple Heart recipient who just underwent a groundbreaking operation to attach a new kind of prosthetic leg. And through his organization, Our Heroes Dreams, Justin Bond is on a mission to help his fellow veterans and slow the suicide epidemic among the veteran population. Justin's life was forever changed on April 9th, 2004. Maybe you've heard of Matt Maupin, the first American soldier listed as missing in action in Iraq. He was captured that day and later killed. Thomas Hamill was a civilian contractor captured and later escaped. He's written a book about the experience. But here's how that fateful day unfolded for Sergeant Justin Bond.
I was with my platoon, 3rd Platoon, and we came in off of a mission. We had been out for several days. I remember I just went and laid down on my bunk, put my weapon over my chest, didn't kick off the boots or nothing, just laid there. I heard Sustato was sick, and Sustato was one of our 6 SAW gunners, and we had to have a SAW gunner on each mission. And I heard, we're out of SAW gunners. We got to have one. And I was just laying there, and in my head, I was like, ugh. I made a promise to my buddy, Sills, who was also one of the guys who was on the truck with me when we got hit. We made a promise in the early on that we're going to volunteer for any mission no matter what it takes, no matter what the situation is, you know? And so I sit up in my bed, and I was like, been out so many days. And I could hear them talking, saying, bring all the ammo that you can load up on. This mission's dangerous. You're going to get hit. And it was a Good Friday, April 9th, 2004, Good Friday. It was a 1-year anniversary to the toppling of Saddam's army when the statue fell, when we took over.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful, crisp morning. I said, I'll do it. My guys were like, you're not going. You're not going with them. You're with us, you know, and we're resting today. And I said, they need a SAW gunner. We're going to go. So I loaded up, and I was with 2nd Platoon now. And when we left the gate, you just knew something. It was in the air. And I remember coming up on the MSR Tampa. It was a huge freeway, like in L.A. And we come up, and the morning was beautiful, though. All of a sudden, you could see smoke from around the country. As far as you could see, mushroom clouds started to go up. You could see tanks up over in the distance starting. And then we looked forward. I rolled forward in my turret. And I looked up, and all I could see in front of us was strips of grass and rocks and bricks going across the lanes of the freeway every 10, 15 yards, 20 yards. We knew there was IEDs planted in those, and the front gun truck had to pick and weave his way through to find, okay, that might be an ID in that bush or an IED in that one. So he picked and weaved his way through going real slow. We knew we couldn't turn these things around. You cannot turn these things around to save your life. I mean, you need like 30 acres, it seems like, to turn these trucks around.
So there's only one way to go.
One way. You're not coming back. We saw the smoke in front of us, and the convoy that left in front of us was Thomas Hamels. He was captured. When we came up on his trucks were fuelers, and they were pointed in all points of the compass. They were just scattered and all on fire. Smoke plummeting from their vehicles. You could see them hunched over the steering wheel where they had been shot already. We knew, okay, these guys were only 20 minutes in front of us. Next thing you know, we heard a shot, and I looked at my driver, and we listened on the radio, and we heard fire from the right, but the radio went chaotic. The next thing you know, another bullet went, and it hit our truck, and I looked at my driver, and I'm like, that hit our truck. And looking, and we're out there, and we're picking, and we're scanning, and we're starting to fire back and suppress the fire. You know, if you're firing, like in the movies, when you fire, they got to duck down, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you stop and reload, then they come up and fire. Only we find out later that there's 1,000 insurgents that have us surrounded, so they don't have to stop and reload.
And how many of you guys are there?
There's 21 of us at this point.
So it's 1,000 to 21.
Pretty fair odds.
I don't know about that.
So we just kept going and kept firing, and I looked at my driver, and he's like, Bond, you're hit. And I didn't even know it. I knew one hit our truck. I knew I felt pressure, and I looked down, and both knees were pulsating blood. I took an AK-47 round right through the center of both knees. It ricocheted off the engine cover of the truck and went back into my left knee again, totally destroying it. All I could do is see people moving out there, but pretty well concealed, and trying to fire in those directions to keep them down. And then I could see people trying to pull, run up and get close enough to get up on the running boards and pull people out. Find out later, Thomas Hamill's convoy, they pulled him out and Matt Maupin out and another guy. And when I saw them, they were walking backwards, and they had them up by the buildings, which was 60, 70 yards away. And there was nothing we could do to help them. I had already been shot through both knees, and the bullets were just hitting us. We had trucks that over 20 bullet holes in the side. Well, my truck took a bunch in the, ate them in the fuel tank. We had trucks with no tires left, axles blown out, mortars coming through the beds, mortars barely missing our trucks. We got trucks where we're hooking up with chains, getting out during the firefight to a couple of chains to pull our own trucks out while still firing back. All of our big guns were down. All our 50s were down. Our Mark 19 grenade launchers were down. We were down to saws and M16s. We were down to my saw and an M16.
And you've been hit through both knees.
Yes, sir.
But you didn't feel it?
Didn't feel it at all.
But you look down and you see what's going on.
I see the blood. I see it. And I didn't have time to do tourniquets, to do field dress, to do anything. It was, the only thing I could think of was, okay, I see my driver over here, and he ended up getting shot in the shoulder and the arm, and I see him twitch, and I'm like, okay, he just got shot. And I'm thinking, if he goes down, how am I going to get over there and drive this vehicle to keep it going, to keep the mission moving forward when both of my legs are shot out? And the only thing I can remember doing was moving my toes and feeling the blood sloshing in my boots filling up. And I'm like, okay, I'm still moving them, still doing that, but I'm trying just to stay calm. Don't get the adrenaline up, which is hard to do in a firefight.
Holy smokes. I mean, didn't you think you were going to die?
It never crossed my mind. What did cross my mind was being captured. And that was, I got my go bag beside me, grabbed my knife as I'm firing, threw my knife in my side pocket, and just prepared, because I don't think we're making it out of here.
Well, how could you think you'd make it out of there? It's 1,000 to 21. You guys are already hit. I mean, all your guns are down, except for yours and some M16s.
Yes,
I mean, I'm sure people are listening to this saying, well, how is this guy here talking to us? What happened? How did you get out of that? How did you guys survive?
You know, the worst part about the whole thing, and the part I don't talk about a lot, is that I look over to the side, and I see two guys pop up. I raise my saw up to them to do what we have to do, and before I could even pull the trigger, they were gone. Somebody else in the convoy took them out.
Because they're coming up to your vehicle trying to pull you guys out.
Yes, sir.
Which is what they had done to the convoy in front of you.
Yes, sir. These guys were about 15 yards out. Somebody else in my convoy takes them out. And I was like, okay. And then all of a sudden, a little kid pops up right beside where they were at. I think it was his son, one of the guy's son. And he looked at me. And we're doing anywhere from 0 to 3 miles an hour. But we're on a curve, a big curve right now, and we're elevated on a somewhat of a hill. This little boy looks at me, and time stood still. And he was, all I could picture I mean, my son was barely over a year old, but all I could picture was my son, you know?
And how old was this kid?
He was probably 7. He would try and get that AK up, and he would get it up somewhat, and he would fire, and it would blow him back. And his eyes were just huge, just staring at me. I'd already got in trouble once for not shooting kids that were throwing rocks, because they would sit there with a pile of rocks, throw rocks, throw rocks, throw rocks, and then one of them would be a grenade. And I got told to take the kid out, and I didn't. And I got reprimanded for that. Here we are again with a kid, and I thought, I'm not built for this. I'll take out the enemy any day of the week. He's not the enemy. So I went to shoot, and I sprayed around him a little bit, and he kind of ditched and went down, and we're stopped. Next thing you know, he came up, and I said, God, I said, listen, I know I told you I was coming without you or with you, and I know you tried to stop me. I said, I don't have any right to call on you, but I am going to call to tell you that you promised that you'll never give us more than what we can handle. And although I said I'm doing this on my own, I said, I'm calling on you on that one, and I can't handle this. And my weapon turned into a machine, and my PTSD stops right there. The nightmares aren't bad with the kid anymore. The weapon shoots around the kid. The kid ditches his weapon and takes off into the bushes. And I know, God, he just took control. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no way, and there was no way I could have lived with myself like killing a kid.
Wow. But you're still right there. This is still ongoing. Your life's still in jeopardy. You're still, I mean, both of your legs are shot. You're bleeding all over the place. They're still 50-1 outnumbering you.
Yeah. Thomas Hamel was captured for 21 days, and then he escaped. And his book, Escape in Iraq, says 760 insurgents surrounded us, but they said that by the time our convoy got there, it was over 1,000 from satellite images. Yeah, we were way outnumbered. And out of nowhere, we somehow crawled out of the kill zone and got down the road a little bit. I can remember a Humvee, now he's Command Sergeant Major Chapman. At the time, he was Sergeant First Class Chapman. He pulls up beside me in the Humvee at a few people. They jerk my door open and pull me out. And they grab my legs and they throw my legs out the window of the Humvee. And they sped off and got me to Abu Ghraib prison, which was just down the road.
Explain what you mean when you say he threw your legs in the back.
So he pulled me out of the PLS, and we had already dismounted down into the truck because it was the firefight was going to be too big to be up on top. And so they got my door open, and they pulled me out of the truck and placed my legs out the window of the Humvee because they were both bleeding, trying to get it above my heart. And I was fading in and out. My driver kept throwing ice water on me, trying to wake me up and keep me going. And I would wake up and fire a little bit and then start to pass out again. I remember when they started to pull me out, I saw movement out behind him. And I pulled the trigger just above their head, and they took my weapon from me at that point.
Yeah, I guess at that point you probably were a danger to everybody.
Yeah. I just vaguely remember doing that. I was just like, oh, my gosh, when I look back. But they got me out. They did a direct blood transfusion at Abu Ghraib prison from one of the prisoners and saved my life there.
Now, how many other guys in your vehicle were wounded?
Out of the convoy, out of the 21, I think it was 17 that got Purple Hearts.
Was anyone killed?
No, we all made it.
How unbelievable is that?
It's not.
It's not possible.
No.
All 21 survive, 17 Purple Hearts. You're one of them, and we're just getting started with the incredible part of your story here. So you're fading in and out of consciousness, but they get you out.
I'm out now.
You're completely out. So from this point for a while, you're only telling us what others have told you about what happened.
Right.
So what did they tell you?
I was in there, and they did a direct blood transfusion. One of the insurgents walked by the bed where we were at. They were transporting him. And spit on one of our guys, and then I don't know if he spit on me or not, but the guy next to me, he spit on him. That guy tells me he just wanted to rip his head off, you know. Here we are getting life-saving treatment done, and the insurgents that we were just killing were trying to save their lives too, and they're spitting on us. So they stabilized me enough to get me to one of the hospitals, the big hospitals. They got me that far. They were losing me again. They stabilized me. Again, did a surgery there, and then they got me to another hospital, Balad, where they did another surgery, and then medevaced me to Germany from there.
But at the prison, is there an aid station that's already set up there?
It is. It's just for the prisoners, and we got our guys there running it.
So this just happened to be the closest place they could take you?
Yes, sir.
They take you there. The medical staff at the prison, which has been treating these Iraqi prisoners, they bring you in, and they say, you need blood or you're going to die. As far as you understand.
Yes, sir.
They don't have a blood bank. The only way you're going to get blood is directly from somebody else's arm.
Either that, they were out of blood in that type. I don't really know. But yeah, they did direct transfusion. They hooked them straight up to me.
So they find an Iraqi who has your blood type. Did he volunteer to give it to you?
He was a prisoner. I don't think he has much choice.
So whether he said yes or they told him he had to, they hook him up to you, and your life is saved because of the blood of an Iraqi prisoner.
Yes, sir.
You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
When they told you that, did you believe it? Because you're out for all of this.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when they told you this?
It was a chaplain that told me this. Yeah. And I was just like, unbelievable still, you know. And I'm on morphine at this point and a bunch of things. But I just remember sitting back thinking about what we could have went through with that, you know.
You talk about the different operations. They get you out of there. They get you to Germany. And now I'm sure once you're conscious again and you're starting to recover from some of these operations, you're probably starting to realize the scope of the injuries that you suffered.
Yeah. And they said, well, you're going to lose both legs. And they talked about amputating in Germany. Then they said, well, let's get him to Walter Reed. I remember I was in ICU in Germany, and I didn't even make the building at first. I was outside on the tarmac under tents because that's how many wounded came in. When I did make ICU inside, I was in the hallway, and that was ICU. And that's how full they were. Mm-hmm. And we get to Germany, and again, they triage and get me into a surgery right away. And I can just remember seeing people missing both arms and a leg. It wasn't about me. I was fine at that point. You know, I'm on morphine. I'm not feeling anything. I'm not hurting. I know I got shot through the knees. And I'm looking at these guys, and their limbs are completely blown off. And so to me, no injuries. I'm fine. You know, let's help these other guys out first.
At what point did it sink in?
Well, they kept saying we're going to amputate, and I kept fighting them on it. I'm like, nah, we're good. I'm good. You know, my legs are attached. It's just a bullet hole through it. You know, I'll do a knee replacement. And I fought them on it for 5 years. They kept saying, if you want to live this way, you're going to be in a lot of pain. And it was fine for the most part. And then finally, one day, I said, all right, it's time. The quality of life is way degraded. I'm looking at these guys on these prosthetics, and they're just going solid. And I thought, that'd be much easier.
And how many operations have you had now?
I think we're at 37.
And counting, since he'll require a few more just to complete the installation of a revolutionary new prosthetic that attaches to a metal spike protruding from the bone. Time for another break, but when we come back, we'll hear about the mission Justin Bond is on now and how his organization, Our Heroes Dreams, seeks to prevent veteran suicides. And also his friendship with America's 43rd president and how Justin's portrait ended up in a new book. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Next week, we'll be back to our World War II generation as we prepare for D-Day with a paratrooper who served with the famous Band of Brothers. But today, we're hearing about the brotherhood of today's all-volunteer military from a man who's doing everything he can to slow the rash of suicides in our veteran population. We've heard how Justin Bond somehow survived the Good Friday ambush in Iraq in 2004, alive today because of a direct blood transfusion from an insurgent prisoner. But the reality, Justin, is that the same battle that nearly claimed your life did claim the lives of other Americans, military and civilian lives. Of course they're on your mind this Memorial Day, but I imagine that's not the only day. How often do you think about them?
All the time. I mean, it could have been us easily. People that I knew over there at the time didn't make it back. You know, and now I put my life work into the guys that take their own life. And they say 22 a day, but that number's nowhere near realistic. It's only 21 states reporting in. And on the way home from Iraq, we had a guy, Nicholas, who had switched from Marines to Army and went over with us. He ended up committing suicide on the way home from combat.
So Memorial Day for you is about more than the guys who die in combat. The numbers of suicides for veterans are right in that mix for you.
It is. It's the biggest killer to our military. You know, we lost 6,000 and some on 20-some years of war, if you count both war fronts, if you add up all the years.
In Iraq and Afghanistan.
In Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, we've lost 6,000 and some. We lose way more than that every year to suicide. We've lost over 140,000 to suicide.
That's unbelievable. Well, I want to hear about what you're doing to confront that and combat that. But I'm sure some people are interested in your quality of life with the injuries you have. I know you don't focus on the challenges. You don't focus on what you can't do. I clearly see that you focus on what you can do. But what are some of the challenges? What are some of the things that are more difficult because you're missing a leg?
You know, getting up out of bed in the morning is a little bit harder. That's one of the hardest parts, is getting up and going. You're like, okay. Getting in and out of the car and going into the store, it's a lot harder to do that. If you have your leg on, you can do it. But then every time you go from sitting to standing, you feel the skin pulling and starting to give way. And after you do that so many times in a day, now your skin is raw and you get the blisters and the skin breakdown. And in the summertime, every couple hours, you got to take off your liner and drain about 2 cups of sweat out. Pretty soon it's raw and you've got rashes, and then you can't wear your leg for a couple of days, so you go to crutches or a wheelchair. Social Security says, well, you're no longer disabled because you're walking in your leg good. I say, yeah, for 3 days out of the week, I'm doing great, you know? What about the rest? And a lot of organizations, a lot of people will say, man, you're not even disabled. I say, yeah, I'm not when I'm out here in the public's view, you know? But when you take that leg off and you're in the wheelchair and you have the phantom pains just start. Phantom pains are no joke. I'm going to tell you, I was in a lot of pain before. I'm still in a lot of pain. Because those phantom pains, it's like I don't know what a cattle prod feels like, but it's like electrocuting you all night long, and you just lay there getting electrocuted. My leg has been black and blue from punching it, trying to get the pain to go away.
The nerves just are on fire.
Yep. Just conflicting with each other and just on fire, so much that your leg is just twitching in pain, and you're just sweating from the heat. I know my buddy Dave Riley, who's the national commander of DAV right now, he's missing both arms, both legs. And he says his hands is like both of them are in a pot of boiling water at all times. And no pain meds can help that. Nothing touches it. So he's just sweating. It could be 60 degrees outside and he's sweating.
And these are probably some of the reasons. Now, when we talk about veteran suicides, a lot of them are people who physically look completely fine.
Yes,
but it's the mental and emotional scars that are prodding them and driving them and bringing them to that point of desperation. But I imagine that there are a lot of guys dealing with what you're talking about, that's what they see as a way out.
Yeah, I wouldn't know the ratio between physically injured and non-physically injured for suicide, but the majority of them are non-physically injured, but that's the majority of the guys coming back, which PTSD is a much worse injury than missing a leg. I'm blessed to only be in combat for 2.5 months and to come home missing a leg, because if I would have went from that firefight to every day after that, going back out looking for those guys that took the lives of those in front of us, I would have had to fight against kids again. I would have had to been on a vengeance to take those lives of those people that took our friends' lives. To do that 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 tours, to leave America with one purpose now, to go back over there to get revenge for your friends. I would have came back with the PTSD problems that the rest of them have, and I would much rather be missing this leg.
And you have a handle on that PTSD issue because of the work that you're doing through an organization called Our Heroes Dreams. Tell me what that is, why it exists, and what you're hoping to accomplish.
Our Heroes Dreams. After I had lost 11 friends to suicide, and I was sitting on the couch and pretty miserable and didn't get up and didn't take a shower for a week at a time, didn't care about living, didn't want to die, but I didn't want to live. I was kind of in that slump that most of them get into. But one day I went out and I helped a friend, and he was going to kill himself, and then he didn't. And I realized, okay, wow, you know, that was kind of meaningful. And then next thing you know, I was put into a situation where there was a suicidal vet, and I helped him. And then there was a civilian. Somehow I got put into that situation. I ended up talking him down. And then pretty soon it was like, okay, I can do this. And once I had a mission, and once I had a reason to live, you know, you carry the price of freedom on your shoulders. You have this huge mission defending America. And then all of a sudden you come home and they strip your uniform away because you're no longer good to the Army. You're wounded. You're no good. You go to the couch. Maybe the VA will take care of you. Maybe they won't. And good luck in life. And you're sitting there. Nobody teaches you how to be a veteran. They teach you how to be a warrior, but they don't teach you how to be a veteran. They don't teach you how to shut that light switch off, that combat light switch, the military light switch. And so you end up just checking out. Pretty soon you check out of society and then check out of life. And usually it's because you're getting what I call VA candy, the Oxycontin, the Norcos, the Vicodin, and then pretty soon you're washing it down with alcohol, and pretty soon you need more of it, and then pretty soon you can't get enough, so a lot of them go to harder drugs. I always say they didn't commit suicide yesterday. They probably wouldn't do it tomorrow, but today they took just the right cocktail of VA candy and alcohol that they could check out. They numbed themselves to the point that it was easy to pull the trigger, or it was easy to go off the cliff. Once I realized that I had a mission out there and that I could carry that mission and help again, it was easy to get up. And pretty soon I would go all day. I would come home and be like, wow, I didn't take my medication today. You know, I didn't take any pills. I would take it to go to sleep, and I would be so tired that I could just go to sleep. And the next day I wake up a little earlier and find something to do. And then I realized that, okay, here it is. If you have a mission, you don't think about the pain. You don't think about anything. And so now that's what we promote to people is, yeah, you were a warrior. Yeah, you had something bad happen to you. I always tell the guys, I say, when you get to your funeral, I said, if you could be outside looking in, do you want your kids and your wife or your parents to say, man, my loved one, he was in the military. Look at all the awards on the wall. He did great. And then he came home and he sat on the couch and he died. Or do you want him to say, man, he did something in the military. There's some awards over there somewhere. But let me tell you why he's my hero. Let me tell you what he did when he came home to change my life and these people's lives. Let me tell you why he's my hero now. And when they hear that, they're like, wait a minute. Maybe I do have something to live for. And when they choose that path, pretty soon the pills taper off, the alcohol tapers off, and the system that we go by and what's working is traditional counseling. It's people trained for PTSD, which is a traumatic event. To me, a traumatic event is a plane crash, a firefight, a wreck, the Boston bombings. That's a traumatic event. What we have is like sending 18, 19, 20-year-old kids that can't buy a beer, but here's a weapon. You're going to go down in civilian terms. You're going to go down to Chicago or L.A. and take out all the bad guys. You're going to go in. You're going to carry your buddies off the battlefield. You're going to go door to door, and pretty soon you're going to turn that light switch off. You're going to come home, get to know your family a little bit. You've been gone a year. Turn that light switch back on. Do it again. 2, 3, 4 years. How many times did you wonder if you were going to die? How many people do you know that died? How many times did you return home knowing your wife and your kids less and less and less each deployment? All the way down to where you finally come home wounded physically or mentally or both. You go down, you sit behind a desk from a VA counselor, and they say, how did you feel when this happened to you? And you say, what do you mean when this happened to me? Which time? Which Purple Heart? Which time that I carried my battle buddy off the field? And see, they're trained for a traumatic event, but what we have now is a traumatic lifestyle. And because there's a disconnect there, these veterans are going through 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 counselors. The counselors, they don't understand, so they give you more medicine because they can't control you and they can't fix you. And you're chewing them up and spitting them out because they don't understand. So why do you even want to talk about your combat experience with somebody that's been trained by a book that's treating you for an event? And there's just a huge disconnect. So what we do is we use Vietnam and Korea and maybe World War II counselors. We use people that have been there, that do understand what it's like with the sleepless nights and the 40 years experience PTSD. And when they come up and they say, son, daughter, today sucks. Tomorrow's going to suck, probably worse. But let me tell you how to get to next year and 5 and 10 and 40 years from now. And let me tell you, show you how I made it through this. Now all of a sudden, they're not alone. Now all of a sudden, the person that they're talking to has been there. And they can say, oh, you have. You have been there. You do understand. I didn't think anybody understood what I went through. The sleepless nights, the night sweats. That bottle of pills sure doesn't understand. The next thing we do is we put on all the band-aids. We do this at what we call a healing retreat. The next thing we do is put on all the band-aids from car repair, home repair, spiritual, PTSD, MST, whatever the case may be that's holding you into that bottle on the couch. We put on those. We help find out that. We put on those band-aids. And the land we're trying to buy and where we've been doing it is at a zoo. And so every morning an elephant delivers your breakfast. You get to feed lions and tigers. You literally get to pet kangaroos and monkeys and play with zebras. And it's an amazing experience. And if we sent them home there, we'd be like a lot of nonprofits. It's a band-aid. You send them back to the couch. Then they get back to the couch and they're like, okay, that was great living again, but now what do I do? Now I'm sitting on the couch. You go back to the bottle. There's no follow-up. So what we do next is we help them find a new mission. We have so many veterans on the couch that have been helped, and they love going out and helping somebody else find their new mission. And that formula has worked 100% of the time. We've got them into a new mission.
Give us an example of that. What are some of these new missions that guys find?
So a lot of guys, I'll start with the homeless ones. Okay, so we get a lot of homeless vets or whatever. We get them in there. We take them through, rebuild their relationships, cars, marriage counseling, homes, get them into new homes. Chase Bank's giving away 1,000 foreclosed homes in 5 years. Home Depot's giving away now $160 million in 5 years to fix up homes, all these things. And so we do that with these vets. And so over 20 homeless vets now we've taken. And in the end, we ask them, okay, what do you want to do? And they said, well, we know homeless vets. I know them. I relate. So we've taken, I think we're at 21 of them where we've gotten them jobs with homeless shelters. Now they, you know, the wife calls, hey, yeah, he's 8 o'clock. He shuts the alcohol off. He may have a drink or two. He's a family man again. He's got a company car. He goes out and brings in the homeless vets and saves their lives. And instead of him being on the couch, that's how it happens. Our very first healing retreat was a guy. He was that big, tall 50 gunner that was with me in Iraq. His wife had left, took the kids. He didn't leave his home in over 3 years. He had pizza boxes stacked up along the walls. He literally did not leave his home. We went over there, and I'm yelling at him through the door, knocking. He didn't want to answer. Finally, he did. I said, Ed. Well, when he opened the door, my wife was with me. When he opened the door, the smell of mold knocked us back. The house was filled with mold. You could see the mold on the walls. Long story short, we ended up getting him out. He came out because it was just going to be some of our unit there and his wife and their families. We had him out at the healing retreat for a week, put on all the Band-Aids, fixed up the car, $97,000 in repair in the home. And I asked him, what did you used to do? And he says, well, I used to backpack and hike and camp. I worked hard to do that. And now he's coming in with a new program called Mountain Warriors under our program, where he takes veterans up into the Forest Service and maintains trails and works with the Forest Service to do all of this. And his wife has now been back home with him for a couple of years. And she's like, I wish you'd come home more than 3 days a week. You know, he's up maintaining trails and he's living again, and he's not on all the medications. And he's out teaching others about his problem with TBI because he has a metal plate in his head from the war. You know, and otherwise, he would be there, stuck on the couch.
Do you have a number of how many veterans you've helped through Our Heroes Dreams?
A little bit over 400.
And who pays for it? Where does the money come from? I mean, you're talking about some hefty impact here and some real life-altering investments that are made.
It's all boots on the ground fundraising. We've ridden a Segway from Monterey, California to Jacksonville, Florida. It took me 60 days to do. And we just rode a Zoom chair from Canada to Mexico, ending in Fresno. So we went 2,200 miles at 10 miles an hour for the 22 a day.
You're doing that to raise awareness. And when people hear about your story, they donate.
Yes,
along
sir.
The way.
Yeah, we have a thing, Operation 22. People donate $22 a month for a year, which is $264. Some of them pay the whole thing. Some of them pay $5 if they can a month. It's all set up online, and people go in and do that. And 100% of it goes into the program. We don't have any employees. We're all veterans that are wounded, that get a VA disability rating, or that volunteer. We do have 3 civilians on our board. The rest of it is the vets we've helped. And they go out and they maintain, and they're helping bring more vets in, and we're just growing.
And one of those cheering the growth of Our Heroes Dreams and the work you're doing is the guy who was your commander-in-chief, former President George W. Bush.
He's a great guy. He really is. You know, I don't even remember meeting him in the hospital the first time, but he has a story that he said, he looked over on my desk and he said, I told him that I had everything right there that mattered to me. I had a Purple Heart, a picture of my guys, and a cell phone. And he said, I told him, sir, my guys call from Iraq, and I picked up the picture. I said, when they call me, I'm going to have to ask you to excuse me, because when they call, I got to check in with them. And he said, when I picked up the picture, I just pushed the Purple Heart away because that didn't matter. And so that's one of his favorite stories. And then he requested us to come out to the White House. So they flew my fiance out. We were picked up in a 1960 Rolls Royce that said Mr. J. Bond on both sides of the door. And they took us to the White House. And unfortunately, he got whisked away by Secret Service and had to leave that day. But things followed through. And he did his first golf tournament 6-7 years ago, and I got a letter in the mail requesting that I attended. And I used to golf, and but I'm like, I want to figure out how to golf again, you know, I'm gonna go see the president. And so I did that, and then pretty soon I was on the Warrior board, his team 43. Since then, I've just been attending all of his events, and we've grown really a lot closer to where, yeah, You can call him a friend. He has open invitation to come out to the ranch and go bike riding. You know, and he's such a great guy. He'll be out there. And so for lunch, he'll go make your sandwich. You might have 10, 20 vets there. He'll go help do that. And at holidays, all his employees that he has, him and his wife cook meal for them. Let them take a break. And he did that in the White House, too. A lot of people don't know that. I get a letter and, you know, I said, hey, will you sign this waiver if you want to be in President Bush's book? He painted a portrait of you and wants your permission to put it in the book. And I'm like, let me think about that. I mean, that's a huge honor, you know.
Did you ask to see the portrait first?
I didn't. I had not seen the portrait until it came out in the book. It was the first time.
Uh-huh.
Part of me is still unreal. We're representing the brotherhood right there. Representing, I mean, I don't deserve to be in the book.
Why not?
There's a lot of guys that gave much, much more. Years and years of combat service that gave many more hours away from their families. Why aren't they in there? You know, I understand there's a limited amount. I barely went in and did my job for a little bit and got in the way of a bullet. That doesn't qualify me to put me in the book. What about the guys that did 10 tours, you know, and then came back wounded? They should be in the book. But I understand that, you know, because I had the relationship with him and he knew me, he's going to put me in there. And so I'm grateful and honored, and I will try and represent the brotherhood and the best that I can be down the road to be in that book.
Well, maybe he wants you in the book because he wants people to know about the mission you're on now. Is it kind of hard for you to believe that the kid who was homeless at 14, was crushed between a couple trucks, who rolled in a wheelchair to re-enlist after 9/11, who should have died in Fallujah and is saved by Iraqi blood, direct transfusion in a prison, is now buddies with a former president of the United States who painted his portrait for a book? I mean, who makes this stuff up, Justin?
Yeah, it's kind of unreal. The only thing I could think of is that God has a mission for us. And if you are a good, honest person and you have that relationship, you know, he's going to advance you as long as you're following your mission. And we may not always know the mission, and we may be on the wrong road 100,000 times. But when you're doing what's right and you're out there trying to help, I truly believe God's going to advance. And because, you know, there's a lot of people's lives being saved through the organization, and it's no longer me doing that. Now I'm just at the helm trying to guide people in the right direction, guide all these vets that we have helped. And it's going so fast that I don't see the magnitude of it usually until things like this when it's brought up. But when I see 30 vets that we've helped go out and help 30 more vets, you know, I just know that God's using me as a tool to advance that mission and to help, because he knows that there's not a lot of programs out there doing it. And so I just, every day I wake up and like, okay, where am I going today?
Memorial Day. You've had a few of them since 2004. What goes through your mind on Memorial Day?
You know, that people always say, oh man, thank you, you're a hero. You know what? I'm not a hero. Why am I a hero? Because I got in the way of the bullet. The heroes are the guys that went over there and didn't come home. They returned home to the 21-gun salute. They're never going to see their kids again. I'm going to go kiss my kids goodnight tonight. I'm going to go crawl in bed next to my wife and be blessed tonight. How many of our spouses are here today? They're going to kiss a picture goodnight. So it's a very tough day.
And with every veteran suicide, there's another family that's forced to face Memorial Day in a whole new understanding. Justin Bond is on a mission to stop that epidemic. If you'd like to help him, or if you know a veteran you think could benefit from the work that he and these other wounded vets are doing, go to ourheroesdreams.org or call 1-844-OHD-VETS. That's 844-OHD-VETS. I also have that information linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where the podcast version of today's episode features more from Justin about his long-term vision for helping his fellow veterans. Thanks for spending this hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, asking you to remember on Memorial Day and every day that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. but it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. And you heard me say there was more of Justin's story here on the podcast, more of his experiences in Iraq, and more of his dreams for our heroes' dreams. So here you go.
Were there some moments before you were injured where you look at it and you say, you know, that was a pretty close call too? That could have taken me out?
Yeah, we were prepping for the Battle of Fallujah, I think. It was time around the time of the Battle of Al-Asad, and we were bringing stuff into Fallujah, and we were putting a one-mile perimeter outside of Fallujah, and they were dropping leaflets saying, you can come out, but you can't go in. And if you're good and you don't want to be in a firefight, you better get out. The insurgents' flak vests would stop the M16 round, but not their own AK round. So they had us bring in 3.5 million AK-47 rounds and 3 truckloads of AK-47s. And they switched us from daytime operations to nighttime operations. Let me tell you, nighttime is a little bit different story than, you know, over there in Iraq. And they definitely had the upper hand then. So we're in blackout conditions, moving in a truck that maxes out at 55 miles an hour if you're lucky, carrying all this, you know, 3.5 million rounds coming in. And we came into this base, and the Marines were going to start unloading it. This one Marine comes up with a forklift, and he couldn't see to line it up, so he turns on the headlights.
Uh-oh.
We are a mile or so from Fallujah, and you can actually see the beginning of the battle starting over there. The next thing you know, a mortar. We heard a whistle. And if you hear the whistle, you're okay. And it comes in, and it hits, and you know they're going to walk them in. They get one side of you, then they hit the other, and then pretty soon they hit you. There was two guys, one from Visalia, and one was from Bakersfield, up on this truck filled with AK-47 rounds. And we're way high up here on this, and we're on a little bit of a hill. And we look at each other, and I remember the look, and we were fully loaded with all our gear, all our battle rattle. And I've got the saw on my back, and I've got extra 400 rounds here on me. And we look at each other, and we're a good 30 feet up in the air, and we know we have to jump. Next thing you know, the next one hits, and is a beautiful display, the most beautiful firework you've ever seen, just a perfect round mushroom thing going up of glowing shrapnel. And it was close enough that the concussion pushed us off, and we went to jump, and that was pretty close. We get up, and my pelvis is hurting a little bit, and we look out on that Marine, he was gone. Left the headlights on, just gone. We never found that guy again. We ended up shutting off the forklift headlights, and for some reason, they never sent any more in. But a first sergeant over there, he said, I'm not here as your first sergeant. I'm here. God sent me to make sure that I get you guys home in one piece. And we had mandatory worship every day. And you could see the battle within people. That battle was, I see it as God and the devil fighting for our souls. And you could see it in the Iraqis, from the little old lady kissing our feet at 60 years old. God bless you, God bless your country, and God bless your God. That's a Muslim lady down on her feet kissing us and saying, God bless your God for you coming to die for me. And here we are having mandatory worship, which I came over here telling God, I'm doing this on my own. We'll deal with this on the back end. I don't feel like I should be even have the right to have worship right now with the unit. And we had some of our people that wouldn't do it. But yet we kept going through these things and making it out, and everything was good. And you could see God's hand saving us throughout these events. And that was another one of them.
Is there anything else physically that you want to explain to the rest of us who are never going to experience this or don't know? I mean, you're not out here complaining. I see that. You're walking around with a smile on your face and you're trying to help people. But are there other things that go along with your physical situation?
I'm sure there are. I don't pay attention to them. I don't dwell on them. But, I mean, that's just some of the obvious ones, you know, is the transfer in between the leg and the crutches and all that. And, you know, one of the big ones is throwing your back out all the time from walking, limping a little bit, and constant back problems. And then with the metal pelvis, hip, and tailbone, you know, I mean, but, you know, it is what it is. I could be 6 feet under like some of the others, or living with the stressors of the PTSD much worse than I have it now. So I definitely am not going to complain.
And you've recently had a pioneering operation that's going to make it so your prosthetic doesn't produce that chafing and the skin breakdown and all that, where it's just going to attach to a rod in your bone?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's amazing. I'm the first veteran to do it.
In the world?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think there is a veteran that did it through the Australian group. He didn't do it here in America. He went and paid for it on his own in Australia. I'm the first veteran that the VA has paid to go through the program here in America. It's brand new to America, called Osseo Integration. I'm the eighth person in America to get it done, the first veteran in America. And, well, yeah, like you said, I'll never wear a socket again. I'll never have to put on the liners, deal with skin breakdown. When the liner quits fitting, then all of a sudden your bone is just resting on this hard piece inside of this leg, and you can't hardly wear it. It causes more blisters, more chafing, and I don't know how the World War II and Vietnam guys did it. They literally took a piece of wood and carved it out and put it on, strapped it on. Mm-hmm. I could never do that. It's just so much pain. Now we're going to have a bone coming out. I mean, we're going to have a rod coming out of the end of the bone that just clips into a leg, and it's a two-part surgery. I'll be down about 10 months, and I'm excited to see the outcome. The people that I talk to that have done it, almost 300 in Sweden and almost 300 in Australia, they all say it's life-changing, that you can feel the pebbles under your feet again, and that no pain at all.
Wow.
So I'm excited.
Well, I'm sure you'll have a lot of people who are listening right now praying for you as you go through the rest of that process to completion. I'm sure this has happened to you because, you know, you say from your experience, just getting counseling alone from someone who hasn't been there isn't as helpful as, at least for the guys you're serving, as what you're doing. How do you respond to the people who say, well, hang on a second, this isn't proven, you don't have enough evidence, or you haven't been doing it long enough, or there aren't enough people that this has worked for that maybe give you that hesitance or that reluctance to dive in?
You know, we hear that, and I do hear that from time to time, you know, because every program out there thinks that they're the one.
Sure.
You know, you can't be better than us. And so we let the numbers speak for themselves, and we let the vets speak for themselves. We haven't lost anybody to suicide that's gone completely through the program. We have lost one that didn't make it to the mission part. He had been through parts of it, but he didn't get to his new mission yet, and he did commit suicide. But over 400, we're around 425 now, I think.
And everyone ends up with a new mission, a new purpose in life, something bigger than himself that he is going after that gives him that reason to live he might not feel otherwise.
Yes, sir. And it's pretty quick and easy. So a good friend of mine now, Jake Gorba, he came through in January. He was, I think, at 20 years old, and he was injured. And he's 23 now, going through multiple back surgeries, can barely walk. And he came up, and his young wife of 19 said he wouldn't leave the house 3, 4, 5 weeks at a time. Just wouldn't leave the house. And she couldn't leave him. She was afraid he was going to commit suicide. We took him through the program a week after, actually a couple days after we got back, we learned about all the Band-Aids that they needed. Well, they were living up at Bass Lake in a house with no heat. It was 30-some degrees in the house in January. Cold. He's got all these injuries. One of the other vets we helped went up there, packed him up, moved him down to Clovis, got his wife into school, got them a couple $1,000 a month increase in their income. just put all the Band-Aids on, all within a two-month period. Got them everything from a couple $1,000 a month increase, a house that was livable, fully furnished their home for them. And all this is done through programs that we work with in the communities. Furnishing Hope, they donate 200 homes worth this year. They're going to donate a brand new furniture for an entire house.
Wow.
And, you know, we couldn't do any of these things ourselves. We couldn't give away a home. We've given away 27 homes through Operation Homefront, through Chase Bank, you know, and fully furnishing and all this. And now his new mission, now he's out helping save lives. He's up helping run programs for us and going out and bringing other vets in. And, you know, and just a few months ago, he was not leaving the house for weeks at a time at 23 years old. And he said, I have no reason to live.
What would you say is your dream for Our Heroes Dreams?
My dream for Our Heroes Dreams is to get this land and to create the camp. And it's going to be in three phases. We need a little bit less than $2 million to do this. Camp Freedom would be for veterans of all generations to get help. Camp Liberty would be for Gold Star families, families that lost loved ones to combat, and families that lost loved ones to suicide. They would have their own camp. And then Camp Uniform would be first responders, you know, our police, our firefighters, and our, like, our Benghazi survivors. We have so many people going overseas and fighting for us. As civilians, they come back wounded to zero.
No benefits, nothing.
Zero.
Yeah.
Like they don't even get their medical most of the time. And they're coming back blown up and wounded like the Benghazi survivors.
So this is land next to the zoo in Monterey, California, that you guys want to purchase and put these camps on. So this is an ongoing place for people to come and get help and get a new mission.
Either that land or there's 360 acres up above Bass Lake that would be perfect as well. Either one of those would be a dream. To build the camp, we already have two of the cabins donated, and we already have the roads promised and that kind of stuff by the Navy, Seabees. They said they would bring in their equipment and they would construct the roads and the power and that kind of stuff. We have so many partners in there and so many groups out there that will help us build it.
Mm-hmm.
So we need around $2 million to build it. That's at Monterey. If you go up to Bass Lake, where there's much more land and it's really beautiful with all these lakes and all that, you're looking at $2.5 million to buy it, and you're looking at probably another $1.5 million to build it out. So it's a lot more money at Bass Lake, but it's definitely gorgeous land up there. Or maybe somebody has some acreage sitting there that they can't get rid of and they need a tax write-off for it. Who knows?